This episode is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and, you know, unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Yeah, it genuinely is like a game changer if you're prepping for the exam. Highly recommend it.
Okay, so imagine this. You steal $1 million from an advisory client.
Wow. Starting off strong today.
Right. Just boom, grand larceny. So you steal it, you immediately retire, pack your bags, and you move to a beach in the Caribbean.
Not a bad retirement plan, assuming you don't get caught.
Well, that's the thing. Let's say a year and a half goes by, and suddenly the state securities regulator discovers your crime.
Okay.
Sounds like you're about to lose your license, right?
You would definitely think so.
Completely wrong. Right. Because of a very specific, heavily tested loophole in the regulatory timelines, that regulator actually cannot touch your registration.
Which is wild.
It sounds completely illegal, but it is 100% true. And we're going to explain why today. Welcome to the Nike Dive.
Yeah, we're jumping straight into the deep end today. We're breaking down the absolute, you know, bread and butter of the Series 65 exam.
Yes, the investment advisor representative.
Oh.
Or as we'll be calling it, the IIR.
Right. The living, breathing human beings of the financial advice world.
Exactly. And for those of you listening, you know, maybe you're walking or driving right now while studying, understand the stakes here. This unit is worth about 5 questions on your exam.
Yeah, which is roughly 4% of your total score sitting in just this one topic.
It's highly testable. But our mission today is not to just read you some dry list of rules to memorize.
Please know, rote memorization is exactly how you fall for trick questions.
Exactly.
Because the exam writers, they literally live for trick questions.
Yeah.
They build these traps designed specifically for people who memorize flashcards, but, you know, they don't understand the underlying machinery.
Right. So our goal today is to give you the logic, the actual why behind the regulations. If you understand how the regulators think and, like, why they built the rules the way they did, then even if the exam throws an absolute curveball scenario at you, you can logic your way to the right answer.
Because the rules actually do make sense, right? When you look at the underlying intent.
Which is
always, always about protecting the investing public.
Always. Now, to make this stick, especially if your brain, like mine, just completely tunes out during standard dry lectures, we are going to use some highly relatable, completely fictional characters today.
I love these characters.
Yeah, we're going to build out some memorable and honestly probably absurd scenarios. Mm. We are going to put them through the regulatory ringer.
Let's do it.
All right, listener, allow me to introduce our cast. First, we have cold calling Carl.
Good old Carl.
Carl is high energy, very enthusiastic, but he does not know a stock from a bond. He just loves to sell.
Every firm has a Carl. I've worked with like 3 Carls.
Right. Next, we have clever Chloe. Chloe is the organizational mastermind. She handles the paperwork. She processes the transfers. She basically keeps the lights on, but she never gives advice.
She's the backbone.
And finally, frantic Fiona. Fiona is, you know, always stressed, always trying to cut corners to save time, working from her basement in her pajamas, and just constantly tripping over compliance rules.
A phenomenal trio.
Okay, so before we can talk about how Carl, Chloe, or Fiona register or what rules they have to follow, we have to figure out who actually needs to be in this club.
Right, the definition.
Yeah, we need to define exactly what an investment advisor representative does. Because if you do certain things, boom, you need a license.
Well, so the Uniform Securities Act casts a very specific net here. It lays out 5 distinct functions.
Okay.
And if an individual employed by an investment advisor does, like, any one of these 5 things, they're legally an IIR. Just one.
Break down the 5 functions for us.
Sure. So, number one, making recommendations. This is the obvious one, right? Providing investment advice to clients.
Like saying, I suggest you buy 1,000 shares of this tech company.
Exactly. You are directly influencing a client's financial position.
Makes sense.
Number two is managing accounts. This means exercising discretion or investment control over client portfolios.
So you might not even ask the client, right? You're actually placing the trades in a managed account on their behalf.
Right. Telling them what to buy or just buying it for them. Those two are pretty intuitive.
Okay, what's number three?
Number three is determining advice. This one is a bit more, you know, behind the scenes. Think of a research director or like a senior analyst at the firm.
Okay.
They might shape the model portfolios or determine the exact investment guidance the firm's clients receive. even if that analyst never speaks to a single retail client directly.
Oh, wow. So their brain is powering the advice.
Exactly.
They're formulating the recipe, even if they aren't the waiter serving the meal.
That's a perfect analogy, actually. Yeah.
Got it.
Then number four, soliciting advisory services. This means offering, negotiating, or soliciting for the sale of the firm's services.
Basically bringing new money in the door.
Yep. And finally, number five, supervising any of the above.
Oh, okay.
Overseeing the people who perform the first four functions.
I mean, that net is immensely wide. It captures almost everyone who isn't just emptying the trash cans at the office.
It really does. But what's fascinating here is why the net is so wide. Regulators want jurisdiction over anyone who influences a client's financial destiny.
Right.
And anyone who brings that client into the firm in the first place. The public is vulnerable.
Right.
The regulators want to know exactly who is interacting with them.
Okay, let's bring in cold calling Carl to test this.
Oh boy. Let's see what Carl's up to.
So Carl works at an investment advisory firm. His only job, literally his only job, is to sit at a desk, read from a laminated script, and get people to sign up for an introductory meeting with an actual knowledgeable advisor.
Right.
Like I said earlier, Carl does not know what a mutual fund is. He couldn't explain a dividend if his life depended on it. So does Carl need to be registered as an IAR?
Yes, absolutely. Because function number four is soliciting advisory services.
Even though he gives zero advice. That feels like overkill, honestly. He's basically just a telemarketer.
Even though he gives zero advice, soliciting alone triggers the requirement.
Really?
Yeah, the regulators see it this way. Carl is the gateway drug to the firm.
Ah, okay.
He is the first point of contact between a vulnerable member of the public and this huge financial machine. The state wants to know who he is. They want him to pass a background check.
So they want him bound by ethical standards.
Exactly. Because think about it. What if Carl starts lying on the phone just to hit his meeting quotas? What if he promises guaranteed returns?
Oh, yeah. If he's not licensed, the regulators had a much harder time punishing him. By forcing him to be an IRR, he is firmly under their thumb.
Exactly. You want to talk to the public about investments, even just to pitch a meeting? You get a license.
Okay, that makes sense. But I'm going to push back on function number five. Supervising.
Yeah, okay, go for it.
Let's say I'm the branch manager. I don't have my own book of business. I don't give advice to anyone. My only job is to sit in the corner office and make sure cold calling Carl and the other advisors don't say anything illegal.
Right.
Why do I need the exact same IRR license as the portfolio manager who is actively trading millions of dollars? Why isn't there just a supervisor license?
This raises an important question, and listener, this is a massive exam trap.
Pay attention to this one.
You might think, logically, there should be a separate manager license, like a hall monitor badge for compliance officers.
Right. I'm just the referee. I'm not playing the game.
But under state law, there is no separate supervisor license for IRRs. Supervising IRRs makes you an IRR.
Wow.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, think about the mechanics of regulatory accountability. You cannot reasonably or effectively supervise an activity if you yourself are not licensed and qualified to perform that activity.
Ah, because I wouldn't know what I'm looking at.
Precisely. How can you review an investment recommendation to see if it was, suitable for a retiree if you haven't passed the exam that tests what suitability even means?
That makes total sense.
How can you audit a discretionary trade if you don't understand the rules of discretion? It's like you can't grade a calculus test if you never pass calculus.
So trap number one for you listening right now. Do not look for a principal or supervisor registration for IRRs at the state level. Supervising equals IRR registration, period.
It's a one-size-fits-all license under the Uniform Securities Act.
Okay, but not everyone in the building needs a license, right? We have exclusions. Let's enter Clever Chloe.
Chloe.
Chloe is the administrative backbone of the firm. She processes the account paperwork. She maintains the client files. She initiates the wire transfers. I mean, she is touching client accounts all day long.
But look at the five functions. She is not making recommendations.
Right.
She's not managing money or making discretionary trades. She's not determining the firm's advice. She isn't soliciting new clients. And she isn't supervising anyone who does.
So, listener, I want you to think about this for a second. Let's say a client calls the firm. The client says, Chloe, I want to transfer $1 million from my checking account into my brokerage account.
A huge transfer.
Right. Chloe executes that massive transfer. Does she need to be registered as an IAR?
Think about it.
Nope. Processing paperwork is a clerical or ministerial function.
And this is trap number two. The exam writers will try to trick you by putting a shockingly large dollar amount in the prompt.
Like the $1 million.
Exactly. Or they'll emphasize how frequently Chloe touches the accounts. They'll write a question saying, you know, Chloe routinely processes tens of millions of dollars in highly complex wire transfers daily.
Sounds intimidating.
It does, but it absolutely does not matter. Record keeping, processing, and executing administrative client requests are clerical. As long as she's not offering her own advice or soliciting, she is strictly excluded from the definition of an IOR.
Okay, but what if the client asks her, like, hey, Chloe, you see a lot of accounts here. Should I put this $1 million in Apple or Google?
Ooh. The moment she answers that question with an opinion, she has crossed the Rubicon.
She's done it.
She just provided investment advice. Hmm. She is now acting as an unregistered IRR and breaking the law.
So Chloe's safest phrase is just, I can't give advice. Let me transfer you to an advisor.
Exactly. Stay in the clerical lane.
Okay, so we've established the who. Carl the solicitor. Yes, IR. The branch manager. Yes, IRR. Clever Chloe doing paperwork. No, clerical.
Right.
Now we have to figure out who is actually in charge of policing these people. Who is the boss? Is it the state where Carl lives, or is it the federal government, specifically the SEC?
Ah, the jurisdictional divide. This is where we have to look at the massive difference between the state definition of an IIR and the federal definition. And to understand it, we need a quick analogy.
Hit me. Give it to me.
Think of the SEC as the FBI.
Okay, the FBI.
The FBI cares about massive, systemic, multi-state threats, right?
All right.
They want to regulate the giant billion-dollar investment advisory firms that manage money across the globe. Now think of the state securities administrators as the local police. The local police care about the guy getting mugged on Main Street. They care about retail investors getting swindled by their neighbor who happens to be a financial advisor down the street.
So the state protects the local residents.
Right. Decades ago, regulators realized it was incredibly inefficient for both the SEC and the states to try and regulate every single firm.
Right, too much of overlap.
So they split the jurisdiction. The SEC regulates the giant federally covered firms. The states regulate the smaller local firms.
Okay.
But here is the shocking fact. This is the pattern interrupt for today. So listener, pay close attention.
Listen up.
Even if an IRR works for a massive multi-billion-dollar firm that is federally covered and registered only with the SEC.
Yeah.
The human being, the IR, never registers with the SEC.
Wait, hold on. That seems completely counterintuitive. If the SEC is overseeing the giant firm, why do they leave the thousands of human employees to the states?
Because the states absolutely refuse to give up jurisdiction over the people sitting inside their borders talking to their local residents.
Ah.
The SEC looks at the firm's balance sheet, their systemic risk, their macro compliance. But the state said, look, if a human being is going to sit in a strip mall in our state and pitch investment advice to our teachers and firefighters, we demand the right to license them, background check them, and monitor them.
Wow. So it's a compromise. The FBI watches the corporation. The local police watch the human on the ground.
Exactly. IIRs never, ever register with the SEC. They always register at the state level.
Okay, but if the human always registers with the state, why do we even care about the federal definition of an IRR? Like, why is it even in the textbook if the state does all the licensing?
Because the federal definition acts as a shield.
Mm.
It determines if the state is allowed to force that person to register when they work for a federally covered firm.
Oh, I see. Explain that mechanism a bit more.
So if you work for a small state registered firm, you just use the broad state definition we talked about. You solicit one person. You're an IRR. You manage one account. You're an IRR.
Right. The five functions.
But if you work for an SEC registered firm, federal law protects you from state overreach. The state can only force you to register as an IRR if you meet the extremely specific federal definition.
Okay, so what is that federal definition? Because I know they're going to test this.
Under the federal rule, an IIR is a supervised person who has more than 5 clients who are natural persons.
Right.
And D, more than 10% of their total clients are natural persons.
Okay, let's break this down meticulously. First, what is a natural person?
A human being.
Mm-hmm.
A living, breathing human. Not a corporation, not a trust, not a pension fund.
Got it. So more than 5 human clients and more than 10% of your total client base has to be humans. Both prongs must be met.
Yes, both prongs. But there is a massive exception to who counts as a human client.
Of course there is.
Qualified clients do not count toward that threshold.
Okay, so what makes a client qualified?
Wealth. A qualified client is someone with a net worth of over $2.7 million or someone who has at least $1.4 million in assets under management with that specific advisor.
Why do the regulators exclude rich people from the human count? Are they not humans?
I mean, biologically, yes.
Okay.
But the entire point of state regulation is to protect everyday retail investors, vulnerable people.
Right.
The regulators basically say, look, if this human is worth over $2.7 million, they could afford lawyers, they could afford accountants, they are financially sophisticated enough to be treated like an institution. They do not need the state holding their hand.
Okay, I am going to play dumb on this math because I know the exam is going to throw incredibly specific word problems at us. I need to test some edge cases. Let's run scenarios.
Bring them on. Let's do the math.
Scenario one, I work for a massive SEC registered firm. I manage 50 accounts. 49 of them are massive corporate pension funds.
Okay.
One of them is my neighbor, just a regular human with a normal income. Do I meet the federal definition of an IRR? Can my state force me to register?
All right, let's run the two-part test. Prong one, do you have more than five clients who are natural persons? No, you only have one, your neighbor.
Right, just one.
So you fail the first prong. You are not an IRR under the federal definition.
Mm.
The state cannot touch you. You do not need an IRR license.
Okay, scenario two. I have 100 clients. Six of them are regular middle-class humans. The other 94 are corporations.
Run the test again. Prong one, do you have more than five natural person clients? Mm. Yes, you have six. Okay, prong one is met.
All right, what about prong two?
Now, prong two, are more than 10% of your total clients natural persons? Well, listeners, 6 out of 100 is exactly 6%. 6% is not more than 10%.
No, it is not.
So you failed the second prong. You are still not an IRR. No license required.
Okay, what if I have 10 clients total? Six of them are regular humans, four are corporations.
Now you hit both. More than five human clients. Yes.
One.
More than 10%. Yes, 6 out of 10 is 60%.
Wow, okay.
You meet the federal definition and you lose your federal shield. You must register with the state as an IRR.
This is where the exam will try to bleed you for points. Listener, trap number four, right here. Pay very close attention to the phrasing. The rule is more than five.
Yes.
If the exam says, a supervised person at a federal firm has exactly five natural person clients, are they an IRR?
Nope.
No, five is not more than five. The test writers will purposely use the number five to see if you remember the more than part of the law. It has to be six or more to trigger it.
Exactly. And they will also try to trick you with a shifting client base.
What do you mean?
What if you have six regular human clients, but then one of them inherits $3 million halfway through the year?
Oh, wow. What happens?
Well, that client suddenly becomes a qualified client. They no longer count as a natural person for the sake of the threshold.
Ah, so your natural person count drops from six down to five.
Yep. You no longer meet the federal definition, and you theoretically no longer need to be registered with the state.
That is wild. The math is incredibly fluid.
Which is exactly why federally covered firms have massive compliance departments tracking client net worth every single day.
Honestly, that sounds like a headache. But okay, so we figured out if you need to register. Now, where do you register? Because America has 50 states and crossing borders is really easy.
You register in any state where you have a place of business.
Okay. Define place of business in regulatory terms.
It means any office where you regularly provide investment advisory services, solicit, meet with, or otherwise communicate with clients. It includes any location held out to the general public as a place where you do business.
Okay, time to bring in frantic Fiona.
Oh, Fiona. Let's see how she messes this up.
Fiona works for a federal covered advisor. She meets the federal definition of an IIR, so she knows she has to register with the state. But she hates her commute into Manhattan. She decides she's never going back to the corporate office in New York.
Good for her.
Right. So she sets up shop in her basement in New Jersey. She works in her pajamas. Hmm. She never invites clients to her house, obviously. Her home address is not on her business cards. But she sits at her basement desk every single day, emailing clients, taking Zoom calls, and managing their portfolios.
Okay.
Does Fiona have a place of business in New Jersey?
Yes. She absolutely does.
That's her house. It's a basement. It's not, you know, zoned for commercial business.
And this is trap number three, the home office trap.
Yeah.
The regulators do not care about local zoning laws. They do not care if there's no sign on the lawn or if clients never walk through the front door.
Really?
If Fiona regularly communicates with clients and provides advisory services from that basement, the state of New Jersey considers it a place of business.
Hmm.
She's operating a financial hub out of that basement.
Wow.
She must register as an IRR in New Jersey. Do not ever assume that home office equals exempt.
Okay, but what if she just goes to New Jersey for like a week to visit her parents and she answers a few emails from their guest room? Is her parents' house suddenly a place of business?
No. The key word in the regulation is regularly. A temporary vacation or a brief remote stint does not establish a place of business. It has to be a regular established location from which she operates.
That distinction makes perfect sense. All right, moving on. We know who Carl and Fiona are. We know the states are watching them. How do they actually get the official stamp of approval? What is the physical mechanism of getting licensed?
It starts with paperwork, specifically the Form U-4, the Uniform Application for Securities Industry Registration or Transfer.
Form U-4, write that down, listener.
And here is a crucial detail that trips up a lot of people. The IAR does not file the Form U-4 themselves.
Wait, I can't just go to a government website, fill out a PDF, and become an IAR?
No. The investment advisor firm must submit the Form U-4 on behalf of the individual. They do it through a massive central database called the IARD, the Investment Advisor Registration Depository.
So Carl can't just operate in a vacuum. A firm has to sponsor him, essentially. They have to vouch for him and say, you know, we are attaching this human to our firm.
Correct. The firm files the U-4. They pay the fees. And part of that U-4 process involves a full fingerprint background check.
Mm-hmm.
Those fingerprints go straight to the FBI to check for criminal history.
Got it. And after the background check clears, then comes the pain. The exams.
Yes, the exams. To register as an IAR, you generally need to pass the Series 65, which is the Standalone Uniform Investment Advisor Law Examination.
Okay.
Or there's a combo path. If you already hold a Series 7 license from being a broker, you can take the Series 66, which is essentially a slightly shorter version of the 65.
What if I'm already super qualified? Like, I've been in finance for a decade. I have a wall full of diplomas. Do I really have to take another multiple choice test? Let's talk about professional designation waivers.
Yes. NASA, the North American Securities Administrators Association, recognizes certain elite designations. If you hold one of these, and it is in good standing, you can waive the exam requirement entirely.
Let's list the big ones so the listener knows.
Yeah.
CFA Chartered Financial Analyst, CFP Certified Financial Planner, CSFC Chartered Financial Consultant, PFS Personal Financial Specialist, and CIC Chartered Investment Counselor.
Right. If you have one of those, you get to skip the test.
But why does the state just let you skip their test? Don't they want everyone to pass their specific hurdle?
Look at the mechanism behind something like the CFA. To become a chartered financial analyst, you have to pass 3 grueling levels of exams. It takes most people over 900 hours of studying across several years.
Ouch.
Right. The failure rate is massive. The regulators look at that and say, you know, if you survive the CFA gauntlet, you have proven a level of competency that makes our Series 65 exam entirely redundant. We trust the CFA Institute's vetting process.
Okay, so if I have my CFP, I am basically a god of financial knowledge. I have the waiver. Does that mean I just skip registration entirely? I just hang a shingle on my door and start charging for advice tomorrow because I'm a CFP?
Absolutely not. The waiver applies only to the exam. That is it. It waives the multiple choice test.
Ah, the plot thickens.
You still have to have a firm file, a Form U-4 for you. You still have to submit your fingerprints to the FBI. You still have to pay the state registration fees. And you are still subject to all the regulatory oversight.
So the state still wants to know if I am a criminal, even if I am a CFP.
Exactly. The CFP proves you know how to calculate a retirement shortfall. It does not prove you haven't committed fraud in the last 10 years.
Fair point.
And another massive point. Your designation must be in good standing.
What does that mean practically?
Means you have to keep paying your dues to the CFP board, and you have to do their specific continuing education. If you let your CFP lapse because you got lazy, the waiver evaporates.
Wow.
Yeah, if you want to switch firms or move to a new state while your designation has lapsed, guess what? You do not have the waiver anymore. You're back in a sterile testing center taking the Series 65.
Keep your dues paid, people. Do not let that lapse. Okay, let's talk about crossing state lines. This is America. Business happens everywhere. If I am licensed in state A and I get a client in state B, do I immediately have to file a U-4 in state B and pay their fees? This brings us to the de minimis exemption.
The ultimate hall pass for IARs.
Love a hall pass.
Right. De minimis is Latin. Basically means too small to care about. The state regulators recognize that if an advisor in New York gets one single client in Connecticut, it is a bureaucratic nightmare to force them to fully register in Connecticut just for one person.
It totally impedes commerce.
Exactly. So they created this exemption. It allows an IIR to have a tiny amount of business in another state without triggering registration.
But regulators don't just hand out hall passes without strings attached. I know there are rules.
Oh, there are strings. But there are two strict requirements, and you must meet both to use the hall pass.
Okay.
Number one, you can have no place of business in that state. Mm-hmm. And number two, you must have fewer than six resident clients in that state during the preceding 12-month period.
Fewer than six, so five or less.
Correct. And as institutional clients do not count toward that number, we're talking about regular retail clients.
Okay, let's put this into an absurd scenario to test the boundaries. Cold calling Carl is registered in state A.
Okay.
He wants to expand his empire to state B, but he knows about the de minimis rule, so he only gets one single retail client in state B. He is well under the fewer than six limit.
Good job, Carl.
However, Carl wants to feel professional when he visits State B, so he rents a tiny windowless broom closet in a WeWork building in State B. He puts a plaque on the door that says Carl's Advisory Services, and he sits in there once a month to make phone calls.
A terrible business plan from Carl. Truly awful.
Listener, direct question to you. Think about it. Does Carl qualify for the de minimis exemption in State B?
Yeah.
He only has one client.
Give him a second to think.
The answer is no.
No, he does not. Because he failed requirement number one. He established a place of business.
A broom closet once a month ruins it.
The moment you have a place of business in a state, the client count becomes entirely irrelevant.
Wow.
You could have zero clients in that state.
Wow.
If you rent an office, put your name on it, and hold it out to the public as your advisory office, you are planting a flag in that state soil. You must register there immediately.
So the de minimis exemption requires both no place of business A and D fewer than six clients.
Yes, both.
Let's flip the scenario for exam trap number five. Carl gets evicted from the broom closet. He has no office in State B. He still has just one client in State B.
Okay.
But this client is incredibly demanding. The client insists that Carl drive across the border into State B and meet with them at the client's own corporate office building. Does visiting the client's office suddenly make that client's office Carl's place of business?
No, it does not. Traveling into a state to meet a client at their home, their office, or like a local coffee shop does not establish a place of business for the IRR.
Okay, good to know.
A place of business is a location where the IRR operates from, not a place the IRR happens to visit. So in that scenario, Carl retains his de minimis exemption. No office and fewer than six clients. He is safe.
What if Carl gets five clients in state B, but they are all in the same family? Like a mother, a father, and three adult children, all with separate accounts. Does that count as one client or five?
Under state rules, they are five distinct resident clients. If they have separate accounts and require separate suitability determinations, they each count.
So if he signs a sixth family member, he blows the exemption and must register.
Exactly.
All right, so you passed the exam or you used your CFA waiver, you navigated the de minimis traps, your U4 is filed, and you are officially a licensed investment advisor representative. You can just put the license in a drawer, frame the certificate, and forget about it, right?
Not even close. You have entered a world of continuous obligation.
Continuous obligation sounds ominous.
It is. Life changes, people make mistakes, and regulators demand that you keep your skills sharp and your public record completely accurate.
Let's start with the public record. Form U4 amendments. We talked about how the U4 gets you in the door. But it is a living document. You have a strict legal obligation to amend it whenever the information on it changes.
Yes.
And there are two very specific timelines you have to memorize for the exam, the 10-day rule and the 30-day rule.
And what is fascinating here is how the regulators prioritize risk. They give you a full 30 days to report almost everything. But for the things that suggest you might be an immediate danger to the public, they only give you 10 days.
What constitutes an immediate danger?
Criminal matters, specifically statutory disqualification events. If you are involved in a criminal matter, you have 10 days to amend your Form U4.
Okay, define criminal matter in this context, because I assume jaywalking doesn't count.
It means any felony at all.
Okay.
Or a misdemeanor that is specifically related to the securities or financial industry, things like fraud, extortion, bribery, embezzlement, or forgery.
So if I get a speeding ticket or even a DUI, those are typically misdemeanors, but they aren't financial crimes, so they don't trigger the 10-day rule.
Correct. A standard DUI is a non-financial misdemeanor. But if you are charged with felony grand theft auto, that is a felony. It triggers the 10-day rule regardless of what it's about.
Wow.
All felonies matter. Only financial misdemeanors matter.
Okay. Let's bring back Frantic Fiona. Here is exam trap number 6, charges versus convictions.
This one gets a lot of people.
Let's say Fiona gets wildly falsely accused of stealing a car. It's a felony charge. The police arrest her. But Fiona has an ironclad alibi. She has timestamp video evidence showing she was in a different state when the car was stolen. She knows 100% that when she goes to court next month, the judge is going to look at the video, laugh, and dismiss the case entirely.
A highly stressful time for Fiona.
Very. So Fiona thinks to herself, you know, I don't want to spook my compliance department or put a red flag on my permanent record. I'll just wait to see how the trial goes next month. Once I'm officially cleared, I won't have to report anything because I was innocent. Can she do that?
Absolutely not. You must disclose the charge within 10 days. The regulators do not care about your alibi, they do not care about your confidence in the judicial system, and they do not care about the presumption of innocence in a criminal court.
I am going to push back hard on that. This is America. You are innocent until proven guilty. How can a regulator force you to tarnish your professional record before you've even had a trial?
I get that a lot.
Yeah.
Because regulatory risk and criminal guilt are two different things.
How so?
The U4 isn't declaring you guilty. It is declaring to the public and your firm that you are currently facing a severe legal distraction or potentially that you might be a criminal.
Right.
The regulators believe the investing public has a right to know if the person managing their life savings was just indicted for a felony. The state prioritizes the safety of client funds over the temporary reputational comfort of the advisor.
That's intense. But okay, if the state formally charges you with a felony, the clock starts ticking. You have 10 days to update the U4.
Yes. And furthermore, let's say Fiona goes to court. The prosecutor looks at the video and says, okay, you didn't steal the car, but you were trespassing on the lot.
Right.
We will drop the felony if you plead guilty to a non-financial misdemeanor of trespassing just to close the case.
Okay.
If a felony is later plea bargained down or even fully dismissed, the original charge must still be reported as originally charged on your history.
Wait forever.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
There is a specific question on the U4 that asks, have you ever been charged with a felony? You cannot answer no just because it was later dismissed.
Oh, man.
You answer yes, and then in the disclosure section, you explain that it was dismissed.
The cover-up is worse than the crime.
Exactly. Omitting material facts like pretending you were never charged with a felony is grounds for the administrator to deny, suspend, or revoke your license entirely. They will say, if you lied to us about this, what are you lying to your clients about?
Okay, so criminal charges are 10 days. What falls under the 30-day rule?
Basically, everything else that is a reportable event. Regulatory actions against you by a state or the SEC. Customer complaints, alleging damages over $5,000.
Okay.
Financial disclosures, like if you file for personal bankruptcy or have a tax lien placed against you by the IRS, civil litigation related to investments,
mm-hmm.
and of course, routine administrative things like changing your home address or changing your outside business activities. You get 30 days to update the U4 for those.
All right, so 10 days for the criminal stuff, 30 days for the rest. Now let's talk about the other massive maintenance requirement, continuing education or CE.
Ah, the never-ending classroom. The NASA IR Continuing Education Model Rule.
How much homework do we actually have to do?
12 credits total per year. And credit in regulatory land is defined as at least 50 minutes of educational instruction.
Not a full 60 minutes?
Nope, it's based on the traditional academic hour. 50 minutes of content, 10 minutes for a break.
Okay, so 12 credits. Can I just take 12 credits on how to market my advisory business on social media?
You wish. No, the content is strictly divided. 6 of those credits must be dedicated to ethics and professional responsibility.
6 credits, half of it.
Yep. And within that 6, at least 3 credits must be on pure, unadulterated ethics.
What does pure ethics mean compared to just professional responsibility?
Well, pure ethics is about recognizing conflicts of interest, fiduciary duty, and moral decision-making.
Okay.
Professional responsibility might be a course on how to properly encrypt client data or how to maintain cybersecurity. Both are important, but they want you spending at least 3 hours explicitly thinking about right versus wrong.
Got it. And the other 6 credits?
Products and practice. Learning about new investment vehicles, complex strategies, changes in tax law, that sort of thing.
So half ethics, half products. Are there any shortcuts?
Well, there are compliance paths, depending on your situation. Let's say you are dual registered.
Meaning I'm an IRR and a broker.
Right. You are an IRR, but you are also a registered representative of a broker dealer, which means you are subject to FINRA rules.
Mm-hmm.
FINRA already makes you do continuing education. NAF says, okay, we won't make you do double duty on the technical stuff. If you complete your FINRA ICE, it covers the 6 credits for products and practice.
Awesome. So I'm completely done.
No, you still have to do the 6 credits of ethics for your IRR license. FINRA ICE does not cover the specific fiduciary ethics requirement of an IRR.
Okay. What if I am registered in multiple states? Do I have to take 12 credits for New York and 12 credits for New Jersey and 12 for Connecticut? Because that would be a nightmare.
It would be. But no, there is a home state rule.
Yes.
If you are registered in multiple states, satisfying your home state's CE requirement is enough to satisfy all the other states, provided your home state's rules meet the baseline NASA model rule.
Let's bring Fiona back.
Always a good example of what not to do.
Fiona is a nervous wreck about compliance. She realizes it is December 28th, and she hasn't done a single hour of her CE. She panics. She logs into the portal and she grinds out 24 credits over a weekend.
Just stares at her screen for hours on end, clicking through modules.
Yeah.
Classic Fiona overcompensation.
Listener, direct question to you. Can Fiona roll those 12 extra credits over to next year so she can take a break and not worry about it in the future?
What do you think?
Absolutely not.
No carry forward whatsoever.
Every calendar year, on January 1st, your CE balance resets to zero. You cannot bank credits. Why? Because the regulators want you learning current information every single year.
Exactly.
The tax code changes. Products change. They don't want you binging a bunch of old courses in 2026 to get out of learning the new rules in 2027.
Which leads to the consequences.
Mm.
What happens if December 31st comes and goes and Fiona simply forgot to finish her 12 credits?
She turns into a pumpkin.
Worse. Her registration status officially changes in the system to CE inactive.
Okay, what are the practical effects of being CE inactive?
You are prohibited from performing any advisory functions. You cannot give advice. You cannot manage money. You cannot solicit. You cannot earn advisory fees.
Wow, so you're just benched.
You are effectively benched. And if you violate that benching, you are committing fraud.
How does she get off the bench?
She has to complete the required CE and pay any late fees. But there is a ticking clock. If she remains CE inactive through the close of the next calendar year, meaning she goes a full extra year without fixing it, she is not eligible to renew her registration at all. It fully lapses.
If it lapses entirely and she decides she wants to come back to the industry like 5 years later?
She has two brutal choices.
Yeah.
She either has to go back and complete all the back CE for every single reporting period she missed.
5 years of missed CE, that's 60 credits.
Yeah. Or she has to reapply, pass a new background check, and retake the Series 65 exam again.
I would definitely just do my 12 credits a year. Retaking that exam sounds miserable. All right, we are moving into the final phase, the end of the line, withdrawal and enforcement.
Let's do it.
Let's say you had a long career, you've passed your exams, done your CE, managed your U4 updates, and now it is time to retire. Or maybe you did something incredibly shady and you're trying to flee the industry before you get caught.
Either way, you're leaving.
Right. So you do that by having your firm file a form U5, the Uniform Termination Notice.
U4 to get in, U5 to get out.
Precisely. But here is the critical question. Do you just get to file the form and walk away into the sunset? Does the regulator's power over you vanish the second that form is processed?
Well, I'm going to guess you know the answer to this.
I'm going to guess no. Regulators have very long memories.
This brings us to post-withdrawal enforcement, and it is where we explain the scenario you teased at the very beginning of the show.
The Caribbean beach scenario.
Yes. There are two different enforcement timelines you must keep straight, the administrative timeline and the criminal timeline.
Let's start with administrative. The administrator is the state securities regulator, the head bureaucrat.
Sorry. The administrator has the power to institute revocation or suspension proceedings against you for up to 1 year after your withdrawal becomes effective.
So even if I retire and leave the firm, they can still formally revoke my license up to a year later.
Yes. For any violations you committed during your registration period, they want the ability to permanently mark your record so that if you try to come back or go to another state, everyone looking at your file knows exactly what you did.
Okay, but that window closes after 1 year.
Right. After 1 year post-withdrawal, the administrator cannot institute new administrative proceedings against you based on that specific registration.
That is the one-year rule for the administrator. What about the criminal timeline?
Criminal prosecution is entirely separate. If you committed fraud or stole client funds, that is a crime. It is referred to the state attorney general or the local district attorney for criminal prosecution.
And the timeline for that?
The statute of limitations for criminal prosecution under the Uniform Securities Act is generally 5 years from the date of the violation.
5 years. Okay, let's explain the beach loophole. Track number 7, jurisdictional confusion.
Right, lay it out.
Let's say I retire, I file my U-5, a year and a half goes by, I am sitting on a beach in the Caribbean, sipping a drink. Suddenly, an auditor back home discovers that I stole $1 million from a client during my last month on the job. That is a massive criminal act.
A catastrophic violation.
The state administrator finds out, can the administrator institute proceedings to officially revoke my license?
No, they cannot.
But it's a crime. I stole $1 million. There's no time limit on crimes for the regulator, right?
That is the trap. The administrator's one-year window is a hard jurisdictional stop for administrative action. It does not matter how egregious the violation was.
Wow.
It does not matter if it was administrative or criminal. After 1 year, the administrator's specific power to alter your registration status or revoke your license based on that old registration is gone. The window is closed.
That seems insane.
But listen to the second half. The state attorney general has 5 years to file criminal charges. So while the bureaucratic administrator can't revoke your lapsed license anymore, the attorney general can absolutely issue a warrant, have you extradited from that beach, put you on trial, and send you to state prison.
Oh.
The 5-year timeline is strictly for the criminal courts. You escape the bureaucratic slap on the wrist, but you get hit with the hammer of the criminal justice system.
Let's talk about the size of that hammer. Trap number 8. If I am convicted in criminal court of willfully violating the Uniform Securities Act, what am I facing?
The maximum penalties under the act are a fine of up to $5,000 and imprisonment for up to 3 years.
$5,000 in 3 years.
5 and 3. Memorize those numbers.
I am going to push back here. The administrator, the head of the state securities division, can throw me in jail for 3 years.
Never.
But you just said 3 years.
I said a criminal court can impose that. This is a massive, incredibly common exam trap.
Right.
The administrator is a regulatory bureaucrat. They are not a judge. They are not a jury. They do not have the constitutional authority to deprive a citizen of their liberty.
So what can they do?
They can deny your registration. They can suspend your license. They can revoke it. They can issue cease and desist orders. But they cannot sentence you to prison.
That.
Only a criminal court system with full due process can impose jail time or criminal fines. If the exam asks you, you know, what penalty can the administrator impose, and one of the answers includes up to 3 years in prison, cross it out immediately.
That is a phenomenal distinction. The bureaucrat takes your license. The judge takes your freedom.
Keep them separate in your mind.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We've taken Carl, Chloe, and Fiona through the ringer. We've talked about the FBI and local police.
We really have.
Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most critical, testable takeaways from this deep dive. Let's punch these out so they stick.
I'll start. Doing any one of the 5 functions makes you an IRR. That includes just soliciting or just supervising.
Trap alert. There is no separate supervisor license. And clerical work, like Chloe processing transfers, does not count as long as she doesn't give advice.
Next point. IRs always register with the state, never with the SEC, even if the massive firm they work for is SEC registered.
The federal definition of an IRR requires more than 5 natural person clients. And D, more than 10% of the total clients must be natural persons. Remember, exact numbers, like exactly 5, do not trigger it. And qualified wealthy clients do not count as natural persons for this test.
The de minimis exemption for crossing state lines requires both no place of business and D, fewer than 6 resident clients. A home office where you regularly email clients is a place of business. Meeting a client at a coffee shop is not.
Form U-4 updates. You have 10 days to report criminal charges, even just charges, not convictions. You have 30 days for civil, administrative, or routine events.
Continuing education is 12 credits per year, 6 for ethics, 6 for products. There is absolutely no carry forward to the next year. If you don't do it, you become CE inactive and cannot work.
And finally, withdrawal. Form U-5. The administrator has 1 year post-withdrawal to come after your license. The state attorney general has 5 years to come after your freedom in criminal court. 5 and 3 means $5,000 and 3 years in jail, but only a judge can sentence you, never the administrator.
That is the core logic of the entire unit.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought, something to ponder as you keep studying. We have spent this entire deep dive talking about the human beings, the individual IRRs.
Right.
But human beings are messy. They make mistakes. Sometimes they go rogue.
Often they go rogue.
Right. So what happens to the firm, the investment advisor entity itself, when one of its IRRs goes completely off the rails? We briefly mentioned the firm's duty to supervise earlier.
Yeah, we did.
Think about how far up the chain the liability goes if cold calling Carl crosses the line, bypasses compliance, and starts committing rampant fraud over the phone. Think about the massive compliance infrastructure that is required to babysit thousands of IRRs across dozens of states, tracking every email, every trade, every U4 update.
It's massive.
When you start to realize the sheer scale of that risk, you will understand why failure to supervise is the single scariest phrase to a chief compliance officer.
It is the nightmare scenario that keeps compliance departments awake at night. The firm is ultimately responsible for the monster they unleashed.
Something to keep in mind when you get to the unit on firm-level regulations. But for today, you have conquered the investment advisor representative. You understand the definitions, you know the traps, and most importantly, you know the logic behind why the rules exist.
You've got this.
You have the tools to beat this section of the exam. Keep studying, keep pushing, and we will see you on the next deep dive.